Welcome back to Post Traumatic Thriving. I am your host, Dr. Randall Bell. I'm joined with Tanya Brown. Hi, Tanya.
Hi.
Hi, and we are so freaking over the top excited to have Jerry Jewell with us today. Jerry Jewell, how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Thank you.
Wonderful to see you.
Likewise. So happy you're here.
Yeah.
I'm glad I got to meet you.
Well, you're gonna really meet us as we really get into your whole life throughout this day. You know, if you're one of the five people on the planet who doesn't know who Jerry Jewell is, I thought, you know, should we have a television star or should we have a movie star? And we decided to have both and have Jerry Jewell. And
I'm not a movie star. You keep saying that.
Well, I say it because you're on HBO's Deadwood.
Yeah, but that's HBO. That's television.
But it's a movie.
Oh, give yourself some credit.
You know, I'm gonna beat you up over the break over this.
Exactly.
I know I'm right. I know you're wrong. Just deal with it.
Just deal with that.
Anyway, we're so thrilled, Jerry. We're gonna talk about your childhood first.
Okay.
But you know, just so you know, we're gonna get into all the fame and wonderful things you've done because you've done a lot of TV and you've done. You've done even a Cheech and Chong movie. You've done all kinds of stuff, but we'll get into that if you want to. You've spoken at the White House 3 times, but let's face it, none of that is as cool as being here with us. Because
hands down,
I was talking to Jerry the other day, and Jerry told me, and I don't know if I told you this, Tanya, but Jerry's longest interview ever was 2 hours, which sounds pretty wimpy.
Yeah.
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 Hey,
put the seatbelt on.
Well, you've done a lot of media, Tanya. I've done a little bit. And, you know, those 4.5 minute segments, I remember I was on CNN. They said, you were so great. You're on for 7 minutes. You know, that's a long time. But, you know, we're going to go for hours because if you really want to get to know Jerry, you're in the right place. Full disclosure, everybody should know, I'm friends with Jerry. I've known Jerry for years. A newer sister, Gloria, we actually went to high school together. Jerry was a little bit older. Jerry was a couple of years older than me.
Three.
So you were kind of in the cool upper older crowd. I was a young punk freshman, but I was in class with your sister, Gloria, who I knew and had a friendship right up. We'll talk about Gloria later. So
there's a story there.
Yeah. But I think Jerry is one of the most fascinating people I've ever met. And we're just so thrilled. So let's jump into it. Jerry, talk to us about your birth and your beginnings in life.
Well, I was born in Buffalo, New York. That was my first disability. My mom was pregnant with me in 1956, September. And she was 6 months pregnant with me. And she was sitting on the front porch of my parents' home. And this car came around the corner. And I guess she was trying to learn how to drive. It was a student with a teacher. And she put the gas instead of the brake. He told her to brake it and she gassed it. Mm. And it went up my parents' front lawn, knocked over the maple tree. And my mom ran to save her life because the tree landed on the porch. And when she ran, she fell. And she started hemorrhaging and the water broke inside. So they took my mom to the hospital. And they thought that they lost the baby. You know, they thought they lost me. Surprise! I'm here. Not that easy. But they were trying to save my mom's life too, because her life was in danger. And they said, we have to do a cesarean to get that baby out of there to save your wife. So they were moving her and prepping her for the cesarean. And I fell out in between the two beds.
Oh,
gee. Oh. Surprise! Again.
And I weighed 3 pounds when I was born. This was 1956. And at that time, I set a world record because I was the smallest baby born at that date that was saved, because you couldn't save preemies back then.
Wow.
Very, very hard. And they put me in an isolate and an incubator. And for 3 months, I fought hard to live. I kept losing weight. I was down to 2 pounds, and they called my parents and they said, get down here, give her an emergency baptism at 4 a.m. because she's not going to live past 6 a.m. She's dying. And they came down and gave me an emergency baptism. I also had a blood transfusion. And I couldn't keep anything down. That's why I kept losing weight. Nothing would stay. So a doctor came in, the same doctor that gave me his blood for the blood transfusion. He came in, he goes, give this girl banana. You know, and I was born the year of the monkey, I know. So they gave me banana liquid. I lived on banana for the first 3 months of my life, and it put on weight and allowed me to live. He was right.
Wow.
Wow.
But later I was diagnosed with cerebral palsy from all the trauma. So I came into the world with trauma. And one of the things that I should mention is that back then it was believed that preemies could not be physically touched by anyone because they felt that it would hurt them. So I was in a little isolate, and then they moved me to an incubator, and anybody that handled me wore a mask and gloves as if they had COVID.
Yeah.
And so I had no human contact.
No, that's tragic.
Until they brought me home 3 months later.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
How much did you weigh when you were actually born?
3 pounds.
So you went from 3 pounds down to 2.
Yeah.
And then you went home with no human contact at 3 months.
Yes.
Wow. Okay, that's a rough start.
That is a rough start.
And by then, by 3 months, I was up to 6 pounds. And I called my parents, take her. She's at 6.
She's gaining weight.
Wow. And it must have been traumatic for your family, too.
It was. It was very traumatic for the family. It's not something that you're prepared for. Yeah.
Right.
You know, yeah. Interestingly, and they couldn't get me diagnosed. They kept taking me from doctor to doctor. And they would tell my mom, she's fine. So she's slower than her big brother. So what? Give her time. But my mom knew intuitively that I was not progressing. She knew there was something wrong. And she finally talked. Now, this is interesting. You'll like this. When my mom was 18, now she didn't have me until she was 32. And when she was 18, she got a job, a summer job in Maine, to take care of a family as a nanny. And one of the kids had severe cerebral palsy. Her name was Ann. And her mother, Ann Tucker, her mother taught my mom everything there was to know about cerebral palsy at 18.
Wow.
Wow.
So both my mom and me knew that this was destined.
Yeah. It was a God shot.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. No question. Mm-hmm. And when that's why my mom knew, she always told me, that she knew I was going to have CP and she knew I was going to live. She kept screaming at the doctors because they said, they told my dad they lost me. We lost the baby, but we're going to try to save your wife's life. And she was screaming. She was saying, no, she's alive. She's in there. She just doesn't want to be born yet. It's too early.
She just doesn't want to come out yet.
She's there.
So you were a fighter from the very, very start.
From the very beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had to.
Yeah.
I fought for my life. And later, when I was diagnosed as having cerebral palsy, finally, and it wasn't in New York, Ann Turner's mother told my mom that UCLA in California had the best pediatric program for babies. You got to get her to UCLA. So my parents picked up and moved to California for me.
Wow.
Wow.
That's something else.
It really was. And I was diagnosed at 18 months old. This is funny, too. You'll like this. We were living in Lancaster at the time, and we drove to UCLA, and the doctor said, Mrs. Jewell, do you mind if we use Jerry this afternoon for a symposium? Yeah, we have about 100 doctors, student doctors, and we want them to witness a diagnosis. So can we do that with her? Is that okay? Wow. And they put me on stage at 18 months old. And you wonder why I ended up the way I did.
It's like it's in your DNA.
Yeah, they put me on stage. Yeah, they put me on stage at 18 months old in front of 300 student doctors. And they're showing them, well, this is how the CP looks like. And I actually have a photo of me on that stage. And you see my mom's hand holding, trying to hold me still. Because I moved a lot.
Yeah.
And, wow. And 18 months old on the stage at UCLA.
You started young in every aspect of the word. My God.
You know, I felt compelled. I almost put on, when I put on my socks this morning, I almost put on my Subway socks because I eat Subway all the time. And Dave over here gave them to me. But anyways, for some reason, I started putting them on. I took them off. And I put on my UCLA socks.
You did? Yeah. Oh, look at you.
There must have been something in the energy in the air. Oh,
shoot.
And my son just got accepted at UCLA this week.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah.
I'm a fight on. Fight on. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm
shout out to UCLA. Oh, no. Well, I'm sorry. We're going to have to let you go, Tanya. You're a USC fan?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awful.
Well, I was born during
you live with yourself.
I don't know. I try. I was born during the game.
You were.
I was.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Well, the reason I brought up that point is that when I was diagnosed finally at 18 months old, my parents filed a lawsuit against a driver in New York for causing the CP. And what they found out was her attorney found out that I was inaccurately pronounced dead when I wasn't, and therefore handled roughly by the head, because they were ready to toss me. Oh, she's breathing. And also, they took me out of the isolette too soon to move me to the incubator, and I lost oxygen and turned blue.
Mm. Oh, wow.
So there was that accident. And then a nurse handled me when she wasn't supposed to with her bare hands, and she was sick. She gave me pneumonia.
Oh, no.
So for 6 weeks, I not only was fighting CP and living, but I also had pneumonia on top of it.
Yeah.
My gosh.
That's crazy. And I read, by the way, we're going to refer to this book in my studious notes here. But I read in your book, or maybe you told me, that for all the trouble, the person that ran and went over the curb, ran over the tree, you know, nearly killed your mom.
Yeah.
The total compensation was what?
The total compensation would.
Well, she had to buy a new tree for $75.
Oh, yeah.
No, she got $80.
She got $80.
$80.
Yeah, she got $80.
Oh, okay.
Tree no worse at least $80.
That's a rough start. Mm-hmm. That's a rough start.
In yeah, life. It is. You had to be like in survival mode from. I mean, even when you were in the womb. From.
Yeah. Say it again.
You were in survival mode when you were in the womb before all of this. Like you were fighting for your life from the very beginning.
I was always in survival mode.
Yeah, from the very beginning.
That's why I'm still here with you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so what's your first, I mean, this all happened and I'm sure you have no memory of it. What are your first memories of?
Well, you know, I was very blessed to have my mom. Mm-hmm. Because she could have coddled me and done everything for me. And I would have been very spoiled and more disabled than I am, just for lack of not forcing me to try to do my best. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Yeah, for sure.
And so my mom put me in school at 18 months old. And they didn't have a bus system back then. I had to take a taxi to school. She put me in a cab and I went to this school in Long Beach that was for only children, only preschoolers with cerebral palsy, no other disability. And you asked me why, what I remember. Mm-hmm. The teacher, her name was Hazel Olds, Ms. Olds.
How nice that you remember her.
And she did not. Oh, my God. She pushed us galore. She was. I mean, I had a physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy. And one of the things that I hated was to put me in a standing table. You know, you had to be strapped into a standing table so that I could learn how to stand on my own.
Oh.
And I had to be in that stand. I had to do my work standing instead of sitting to make my legs stronger. Oh, I hated it. And one time I had a tantrum. I am not going to go in there. No, no, no. And she said, are you going to continue to scream? Okay, she picked me up and put me in the closet.
She put you in the closet?
Yeah, so that was my first time in the closet.
Oh my gosh.
She put me in the supply closet. She goes, you're going to stay there until you stop screaming and let me put you in the standing table.
That is funny. Wow. My gosh. But you know what? What a blessing that you had a mom who was tough on you and a teacher who was tough on you.
Oh, she was.
Yeah. And that's a gift.
Oh,
that they gave you.
I mean, anybody who had Hazel tell you the same thing.
They feared her in a good way.
She was ruthless. In fact, I finally reconnected with her when I was on Facts of Life. She must have been in her late 80s. And I think this was 84. And she still lived in Long Beach. And so I'm driving to her house. She gave me direction. And when I got to the door, she said, you're late.
She's still bringing out the winning spirit.
And I said, well, you know, what can I say? I got lost. How could you get lost? He used to live in Long Beach. I was two.
And I had to take a cab.
And then I, you know, I I cherished her. She was my teacher from 18 months old until six.
Till six?
Yeah. So she was they say the first 5 years, mm-hmm. She was hard on me. But when I had to leave her school, I was bawling. I want Miss Old. I want Miss. No, it's time for you to move on.
Oh.
I cherished her. She told my mom one day that she had a hard time keeping up with me because I was so fast up here. She would have to think of new things for me to do because I could do them quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And she put me in the pool, 18 months old. I learned how to swim before I learned how to walk. I didn't learn how to walk until I was four.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what are your that's first memories in, you know, growing up as a little girl? What was it like being just a little kid?
I had two older brothers, David and Fred, who were 7 and 10 years older. And I was very blessed to have the brothers that I had because they didn't treat me any differently.
Mm-hmm.
David especially spent a lot of time with me. He was 10 years older than me. And they were just, you know, if it weren't for my brothers, and then 3 years later, Gloria was born, and she was a godsend. Mm-hmm. So I just remember, you know, my parents had to buy parallel bars and walkers and all kinds of stuff. And I remember, you know, my mom was just as bad as Miss Olds. You're going to walk in the parallel bars. Oh, if you're going to watch TV, you're going to do the parallel bars first. So I was very blessed.
Uh-huh.
I have nothing to complain about. I had huge support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So tell us more about your childhood.
Well, I was very blessed to have my sister Gloria, who was born 3 years later. And the irony of that is that when Gloria was born, my mom felt guilty because she had a little 3-year-old who hadn't even learned how to walk yet. And she had a newborn baby. Mm. And she called all her close friends asking to adopt Gloria. So she could take care of Jerry. And I thank God she never, her friends wouldn't do it. You're crazy. No, I'm not going to adopt.
It's actually like bringing tears in my eyes right now.
But yeah. That's how much mom was dedicated.
Yeah.
It wasn't that she didn't love Gloria. It was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But she knew that I needed a lot of care. How is she going to care for two babies?
Yeah.
And I'm so glad she didn't put Gloria up for adoption because she was a godsend. Gloria and I are kindred spirits. I believe in past lives. And I believe that Gloria and I were together many, many, many times. And this was one of many. And Gloria had a sense of, well, my whole family was, my brothers also had a sensitivity. But she knew that my world was different than hers. And she knew that I was bused to special school. And I never had a normal childhood, per se. So when we played school or house or any of that, we used to play special ed. We never played regular school. And she would help me make wheelchairs out of shoe boxes and put popsicle sticks and rubber bands up their legs for leg braces. And this one doll that I didn't like very much, we just took his head off.
What does that say? I'm not even going to I'm not going to psychoanalyze this right now. That's going to go in the memory bank for later.
Just beware, Jerry.
Yeah.
But the fact that she would play with me on my terms was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
That's a blessing.
Yeah. And so where are you living at this time?
Well, we're living in Garden Grove and then Fullerton.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So did you ever go into, you know, a mainstream school outside of a special needs school?
I went briefly in the seventh grade. No, I went half time in the sixth grade because the special ed that I went to in Fullerton was shared property, Woodcrest, and then Woodcrest Special. Mm-hmm. Do you follow me? Mm-hmm. And I was in Woodcrest Special. So they allowed me to take a regular sixth grade class over at the regular Woodcrest for about 2 hours, 3 hours a day to see how I did. Mm-hmm. I thought I did fine, no problem. And then in junior high, they sent me to Ladera Vista Junior High School for the summer to see if we could make a permanent inclusion situation. And I thought I did really well. I took three courses. I got two B's and an A. I thought, wow, this is it. Awesome. I get out of special ed. And then when September rolled around, the bus company came up to my door and said, we're picking you up Monday at, I think it was 7:30 or something like that. I said, no, I'm going to Ladera Vista Junior High this year. Well, you're on our list to pick up to take you to Woodcrest Special. Mm. But I got two B's and an A.
Right.
And nobody told me the truth. I was so devastated. And my mom didn't have the heart to tell me because she knew I had my heart set on it.
So your mom knew?
Yeah, she knew. Mm. But she didn't know how to tell
me.
You
were crushed.
I was crushed. And years later, I think it was 1984 again. I got hold of all my childhood records from the schools because I told them that they were doing my life story and I needed all this stuff, things that I had never seen before in my life. And in that folder was my report from Ladera Vista Junior High. You know what it said? Mm. It said, Jerry is a sweet little girl. She's very smart. She tries really, really hard to keep up with the rest of the class. She does well, but she eats lunch alone.
Oh.
Mm.
And she doesn't play with kids at recess. So we think it's best that she go back with children like herself.
Oh. Mm. Oh.
You separate me from kids without disabilities for most of my life and expect me to make a magic transition in a two-month period? No way. Yeah. And I wasn't eating lunch alone. I was eating with Carol Burnett, Johnny Carson. I had this fantasy that I was in show business. And I kept that fantasy up from junior high all through high school. When I went to the library, my mom was really impressed that I would go to the library to study. She had no idea what I was really doing.
What were you doing in the library?
That was MGM Studio.
That you had an imagination.
Yes. And my mom's 69 Biscayne Chevy with the Rolls. And this is what I've learned about those years is that, have you ever heard the term creative visualization?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I did. I created my future from early on.
Yeah.
This is what I wanted.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yep. I don't think I've ever told you this story, but there's such a striking parallel I've got to tell you. I also went to Ladera Vista Junior High School.
Oh, okay.
And we went from sixth grade elementary to junior high, at least where we're from. Yeah. And Mr. Hamm, my sixth grade teacher, didn't seem to think a lot of me, although I thought highly of myself in terms of my math abilities, but he put me in remedial math. And on the first day of class, and there are three levels of math, I don't know if you remember that, but he put me in the lowest. And I literally opened the book and it was like literally 2 + 3. And I was thinking, Mr. Hamm must think I'm really pretty, you know, slow here. And I go to the last end of the book to see how far do we get up to. And it was like 17 + 4. And
oh my gosh.
So I went to the counselor at Ladera Vista Junior High. And Mr. Morris, I remember his name. And I said, Mr. Morris, you know, I'm in too low of a math. This is ridiculously simple. I don't know what Mr. Hamm thought, but you know, I'm a little smarter than this. Well, by accident, I don't know what it was, but he put me in the advanced. I just wanted to be in the regular middle math like everybody else.
Got it.
And so I'm in the advanced math. I didn't get A's, but I got like B pluses. I did all right.
Okay.
And from that time, all the way from junior high school through high school, I was in an advanced math. And everybody thought I was a brainiac. I wasn't. I was, you know, I was a Fullerton High School, you know, go to the beach, you know, every spare second, you know, guy. And, but because of the persona, everybody telling me I was smart and thinking I was smart, you know, it started to wear off. So I got to ask you the question, what did this do to your self-esteem being thinking you're doing well and being held back, the opposite of what I had at the exact same school?
I would say that a part of me didn't care anymore.
Hmm.
It was like, it doesn't matter whether I get an A or an F, how hard I try, how hard I don't try.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be stuck what society wants me.
And they never asked your opinion.
No, never. But I mean, it was really not wiser than to base my socialization with education, academics.
Right.
You know, that comes later. I can only do one at a time.
Right. Mm. Yeah. But okay. They put you in a box.
So you're back in. Go ahead.
I finally was graduated from special ed. Wow. Yeah, they couldn't hold me back any longer.
How old were you at that point? Let her fly. Let her flourish. We can't hold her back anymore. How old were you?
And I was allowed to go to Troy High School in my own neighborhood in Fullerton. Nice. And
did you start as a freshman at Troy?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I did. And it was a dream come true because this was the school that my brother Fred went to. Wow, I get to go to a regular school.
Yeah.
And the only thing that I was against, even though I only lived a couple miles, maybe 3 miles from Troy, they still had to bus me with the same bus system that took me far away to Woodcrest because the city wanted special needs children regardless to use a bus. We can't afford to have any accidents on the way to school. So I was so pissed at that. I was like, you never let go.
Yeah. Well,
so I intentionally got kicked off the bus.
Hmm. You got kicked off the bus. You're such a bad girl.
Oh, how'd you do it?
Well, truthfully,
it's funny.
I'm having the feeling there's two versions of this story.
No.
All right. So how'd you get kicked off?
The driver couldn't stand me. And what I found out through the other kids, because I hated country western music, I was in the Partridge Family. So
you were into what? The Pilgrim? The witch?
Partridge Family.
Oh, the Partridge Family.
Oh, yeah. David Cassidy's part of the story. Just wait.
But what the kids were not supposed to tell me is that every time they came to my house, he would crank up country western. Just because he knew I hated it. And we didn't like each other. There was something about him that bothered me, and I couldn't pinpoint what it was. But he was just creepy in my mind. And then one day, they came to the school to pick us up, and they were loading wheelchairs first, because they have to strap them in and everything, and then the walkers could get on. And I got on, and he was mad because I got on because I wanted to sit down. I didn't want to wait. Typical Jewel. So I'm sitting there, and I see him abusing one of my classmates with muscular dystrophy. He's abusing him verbally. He said to him, "What, your parents don't love you? How come you always come to school with greasy hair? Do they ever bathe you? You smell."
Mm.
Well, kids can be so cruel.
No, this was the bus driver.
Oh, this is the bus driver. Yes, sir.
Bus driver. And I was just...
That's cruel.
It was cruel. He said, "Why can't you be like the other kid with muscular dystrophy? Their parents take good care of them." Mm. And I told on him.
Good.
And I knew I had to be sensitive. I couldn't let any of the other kids know because it would have made it worse. So I had to trust a teacher to get rid of this guy, but don't make it worse. Mm-hmm. And they did. And ironically, he was arrested a year later for some horrible, horrible crime. I mentally blocked it. So I was right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So you had in early life, you were a fighter, and you also didn't run away from conflict. Mm-hmm. You saw something going down that was wrong, and you spoke out about it.
Well, you know, that's not the first time that happened. When I was living in Garden Grove, I was on the bus 6 hours a day because the only special ed they had here back then was in Santa Ana. And I was the first kid to be picked up and the last kid to be dropped off. And so I remember we started a new school year at this school in Santa Ana. We had a new bus driver. And, you know, half the kids couldn't walk, half of them could. And he drops off all the kids except three, me and two others. And he gets on the freeway. He's not supposed to get on the freeway. And I was, how old was I? I must have been 7 or 8. And these other kids were 6 and 5. They were even younger. And they couldn't walk. I was the only ambulatory. So he gets to a park. And he's supposed to drive each of these children to our own homes. That's the law. Mm-hmm. He went to a park and he carries the kids that can't walk and place them under a tree. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, well, I forgot to put gas in the bus. And I'm legally not allowed to take special ed students to a gas station. So I'm going to leave them here.
Oh, my God.
So I can get gas. But I'll take you home first. And I said, no, you're not. Yes, I am. No, you're not. And I ran off the bus. And I sat next to these two kids under the tree. I said, if you're going to leave them here, you're going to leave me here.
Yeah.
And we were there until nightfall.
Oh, my God.
He left?
Yeah, he left. Never came back. And,
oh, my God, and you guys are kids.
Two kids that couldn't even walk, and one was nonverbal.
Totally vulnerable.
And so, of course, my parents and these two kids are calling the bus company, where are our children, where are our children? And I'm sitting there calming these upset kids down. I remember this. I remember saying to them, don't cry. They're going to figure out we're not home yet. Somebody's going to come and get us. Well, they might not get me, but they'll get you. And I was their protector.
Yeah.
So that at a very young age. And what happened with that was the school called the bus company. And sure enough, you know, they said, take us to where you drop these kids off. And I was living in Garden Grove. And I asked my dad years later, do you remember what park he dropped us off at? It was in Whittier.
Oh, my God.
Just so those who don't know, that's miles far. Away. Miles and miles.
Miles and miles away.
Yeah, that's far.
He was probably planning to come back, but he couldn't because of all the phone calls from the parents. Where's my kid?
My God, it's terrifying.
Now, years ago, I mean, he was fired, yeah. But years ago, that would have been on CNN.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, today it would have been on CNN. Yeah. Then it never got a bleep in the news.
Did he get fired?
Oh, yeah, he got fired.
What a nut job. Oh,
my God.
Yeah, and who knows what he was planning if he had come back. But I knew intuitively to get off that bus.
Absolutely. Because you would have been in danger. He would have done something horrible to you.
Yeah.
Well, that leads us into, we're talking about your life with, we're here talking with Jerry Jewell about life, what real life was like. Mm-hmm. You are easily the most famous disabled person on the planet.
There's a lot of...
No, I'm right. I'm right. You're wrong.
Not a lot.
No, I mean, and this is what disability really looks like mm-hmm. and looked like. I mean, this is tough to hear because, I mean, Jerry and I, you know, we're all friends. To hear that this is the background of a dear friend who you mm-hmm. care for and love deeply, it's tough. But I'm going to go there. I mean, there was abuse that you went through as a kid. And to the extent you're comfortable sharing, what would you like to share about that topic? Is all pre-college kind of stuff.
Well, there was, okay. A friend of my parents, I think that's what you're alluding to.
Yeah, well, I'm alluding to whatever you want to allude to.
A friend of my parents was staying with them. And Gloria was spending the night with a friend. My dad worked graveyard shift, so he wasn't home. And his wife was asleep in the guest room where he should have been, and my mom was asleep. and he sexually molested me for, God, it must have lasted about an hour or so, it seemed. And I felt, now I was 17, but you have to understand, emotionally, I was probably 12 because of all the special ed and not having experiences to grow. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So I was a lot younger than 17, and he was probably, I would say, 13 to 14 years older than me.
Oh, my God.
And what's interesting is that I had never had a date in high school, never kissed, no physical contact. This was my first physical contact. And it was conflicting because I was thinking, wow, this is the two thoughts that went through my head. Is he doing this to me because this is what teenagers are supposed to do and I'm supposed to enjoy it and I'm pretty like my sister Gloria? I did think that. Or is he doing this because he's taking advantage of me and know that there's nothing I can do about it? And I wrestled with that, you know, and then I became angry and then I became scared. And it was now about, God, it must have been 5:30 in the morning, and I got dressed and I go to the front door and he blocked my way. He said, where are you going? I said, I'm leaving at 5:30 in the morning. Yes. But people would think something happened. That something did happen. Well, can't you just do one more pretend like it never happened? I'm leaving. Mm-hmm. The reason I didn't wake up my mom or his wife, this was the other fear that ran in my head. Well, he's good looking. He's intelligent. And I'm the disabled kid. He can easily say she made it all up. Who are they going to believe? Me or the handsome friend of my parents? See, it's all image, you know? And so what I did was, is I got in the car and I went to a street where I knew that I could see my dad coming home from graveyard shift. And when I saw his car at 6:30, I went home knowing that he was there. I wouldn't go home without my dad there. Mm-hmm. And I walked in. He goes, where the hell were you? I said, my friend Jane called and her parents are leaving for the mountains today and she needed that jacket she left. I mean, I wouldn't tell anybody. Yeah.
I mean, this is, you've shared with me before that with disabilities, and at this point, you've have layered trauma going on. You're born with a disability. You're not connecting with the able-bodied kids, you know, and you're sent back to the disabled school. That's traumatic at some level. And then here's another layer of trauma with sexual abuse. And you were sharing with me, Jerry, that a lot of disabled kids are abused sexually and other ways because they really can't fight for themselves.
Yeah. They're vulnerable.
Vulnerable, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I never thought of it that way, but that's really an ugly side of society.
Yeah.
Well, it is, but it's occurred for eons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, I hate to say this, it's a fact. I want to say something. You know, I've touched a lot of trauma here, but you have to understand, like what I said about driving to MGM Studios and it was the library.
Yeah.
I used to play tennis against the freeway wall, the 57 freeway. Tennis ball and a racket. And I used to pretend all through high school that I was a professional tennis player. So I think my coping method, mm-hmm. you know, in between trauma, was that I had a goal, I had a dream, and nobody was going to take that from me. And the interesting thing I wanted to mention, the tennis, because I was playing against the freeway, and I always had this thing in my head that if I weren't born with cerebral palsy, I would have been a professional tennis player. That's what I wanted to do, but I knew I couldn't with CP.
Who says?
Now jump to 1985. I was doing all these celebrity sports events and charities because I had CP. Everybody wanted me. And this was in Lake Tahoe. And again, they asked me again to come up and be there and sign pictures. And I was complaining to my friend Kelly. I said, all they do is have me come up here and sit here. It's like I'm a visual. You know, they never let me do anything. I said, well, why are you telling me? I said, because you're my friend. Well, do something about it, Miss Proactive.
Right.
So, well, okay. And I went up to the executive producer and I said, you know, I'm very honored that you keep bringing me back for this wonderful event, but I don't do anything. All I do is I sit here and I have cerebral palsy for 2 days. I want to do something. And he's perplexed. He says, well, what can you do? I can play tennis. Really? Are you any good? Uh-huh.
I think I am.
Okay. Well, let me work on that. And what was going through my visual was I thought that he would get a celebrity to hit some bars with me just so I could do something. I wasn't thinking anything beyond that. That evening, under my hotel room door was a note telling me to be out on court A at 8 a.m., that I was playing doubles with John McEnroe.
Oh!
Arthur Ashe.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And Wayne Cook for ABC Wilder's Florida Sports. And I was like, holy
Oh, my yes. gosh. Talk about the icons of tennis. But my gosh.
My friend Kelly had a nickname for me. She called me Jewelhead. Well, you did another Jewelhead. Why did you say you knew how to play tennis? I thought it was just going to be just a little thing on the side. Well, you can't get out of this now.
Surprise.
I said, who's Wayne Cook, by the way? Well, remember that guy you met yesterday? He has cerebral palsy. That guy? Very well-built, excellent tennis player. Oh, my. So the producers were thinking a celebrity, a pro tennis player, and a CP, pro tennis player and a CP would be an even match.
Oh,
oh
wow.
My gosh. Nope. Not so even.
No, it wasn't. But I was John McEnroe's partner. And we won.
Awesome.
Granted, John cheated because so many times it would land on my side of the court and he'd run over. I got it. And I actually scored once. And the only reason I got the point was because everybody was so shocked that I hit it. Nobody went after it.
He didn't hear that.
Wow.
So the reason I bring that story to the forefront is because there goes the tennis against the freeway. Again, I created it without even knowing.
You know, I think what everything that you're sharing, all this, you know, the visualization, creative, you know, visualizations, manifest, it's like you've manifested everything that that is happening in your life. So for our viewers and our listeners, like, I think, you know, we need to really understand like the power of the brain, you know, and you've created that, but from
absolutely
from this small.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
One of the most successful people I ever met, she was the executive producer of a major TV show. And I met her when I was invited to be on the show, but I went in her office afterwards. She showed me this huge vision board that covered two walls of her vision.
Oh, wow.
And she's now living the complete vision that's been up on the wall for years.
Yeah.
The stuff really works.
It does work. It does work. You just need to apply it.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And you're a living
yeah,
testament. Both. You're both. Testament of that concept. Uh-huh.
I'm having a bad hair day today, though.
So. Well, you look great.
Why do you say that? It's good.
I have a permanent cowlick in the middle of my
head. Well,
you're fine.
Here.
What do you want us to do with all it? Better. Okay, it's all good.
Deal with it.
You're
all
fine.
All right, now you look fine. So, during a break, we were talking, you know, you're bringing so much to the table because, I mean, the title of the podcast is Post-Traumatic Thriving. Mm-hmm. I can't think of a more exceptional example of that than you, Jerry Jewell.
Yeah.
I want to, we talked about some of this really heavy, ugly stuff that, you know, we're going to have trigger warnings all over the place. Mm-hmm. But I want to go back to junior high school, elementary school, high school, and I, to the extent you're comfortable talking about it, I know that there was some bullying that went on. And can you share some of that reality with us?
Well, the bullying that I remember, oddly enough, well, I can remember specifically maybe two or three times, but you know, I'm also hearing impaired. I have about 78% loss. Mm. And I didn't wear hearing aids as a kid until I was 13. But I think my hearing loss was a blessing because I didn't hear half the shit that
people were saying. You're like, yes. Hi. Actually, you know what? What a great positive way to look at that. It's probably true.
But
that is funny.
But I remember when we were in Fullerton, there was this family that lived about, three houses down from me. And my brother Fred was babysitting me and Gloria. And he told me that I could ride my bike, but I couldn't go past their house because he couldn't see me past that house. He wanted to watch me. So I would make a U in her driveway and come back home. Now, previously to this, you should know this, she told me never to step on her property. And she didn't want me to talk to her kids. She wanted her kids to play with normal kids. not kids like me. And this particular day, when I was doing the U, she came around the corner in a car and chased me in a car, and I'm on a bike. There's a parked car in front of me. I'm not quick enough to get on the sidewalk, and she blocks my way, can't go around it. She rolls down her window and said, "I saw you. You were on my property."
This is an adult woman, not even like a kid bullying you at school. This is a grown woman.
Oh, shame on her. Unbelievable. And it was very traumatizing because she was yelling at me in front of all the kids in the neighborhood. And I felt this tiny, I'm sorry. Mm. And I ran in the house crying, and I slid under my bed. I was so mortified. And my brother Fred comes into the bedroom. "What are you doing? Leave me alone." And he pulled me by the legs out from under the bed. "What happened?" "That mean lady's down the street." And I told him what she said to me. He was so mad. He said, "You wait here." He walked down to her house, rang her doorbell. She answered, "You stupid. How could you chase a kid with cerebral palsy on a bike and you're driving a car?"
Yeah.
She said, "I was driving very slow. I was not chasing her. I just wanted to let her know that she couldn't be in my property." Why not? And he called her every name in the book. And she slammed the door on his face. He opened it again. "I'm not done with you." And my brother was 16 at the time. And I remember that abuse.
Yeah.
Yeah. And go ahead. Didn't she come to, and wasn't there a confrontation with your mom with this woman? That's my recollection.
Yeah, well, when my mom came home from work, she comes up the driveway, storming up the driveway. Doesn't say anything about me on the bike or turning her drive. "Do you want to know what language your son used?" I mean, what is this lady's problem? And my mom had already heard the whole version from Fred. "Does it not upset you that he used this language in front of my children?"
She just didn't get it.
And she said, "He was instructed to take care of his sisters, mm-hmm. and that's what was needed that afternoon.
Yeah.
So will you please leave? You didn't mention that you yelled at my daughter in front of all kinds of kids mm-hmm. in the neighborhood. You humiliated her. I only didn't want her on my property because she had cerebral palsy, and if she fell on my property, my homeowner insurance wouldn't cover it." And my mom,
that was her like, thinking,
"Oh Lord." So then she left. She waited for my dad to come home.
What's up with this lady?
So my dad comes home. And she comes going up the driveway. "You're not going to believe what language your son used." And my dad said to her, "You know, my wife told me everything. And I'm not here to make any decision about anything because she already made the decision. She asked you to leave. Why are you back?" She was done. But nothing. Turn around. Walk on home. And by the way, don't trip in the driveway.
Because my house insurance may not cover it. I love your family. You guys are a whole bunch of strong cookies.
Yeah. Yeah. Your family is really remarkable. And what I remember in high school about you, Jerry, is that you were, you know, and I don't know that people realize this, and it hasn't really come out through your story yet, but at least my perception, I knew who you were. I knew your sister, of course, because we were the same age.
I know.
But you didn't know who I was at the time. Gloria introduced us later, but you were one of the cool kids. I mean, you had a...
Where did you get that from?
Well, I'm a freshman. I guess everybody older than me is cool, but no, you had an engaging personality. I noticed you from afar. You seemed on the outside. You seemed fine.
There he is.
I don't know what that means, but no, but
seeing me from afar.
Well, I saw you from afar, in high school.
He's a cool cat.
Well, no, but I mean, you did have some good moments in high school.
I did.
Yeah.
My greatest moment in high school was taking drama, because that, again, fulfilled my goal to become an actress, a comedian. And so I got to do some plays. I did Tea House of August Moon. I was cast as a 98-year-old Japanese alcoholic.
What's the name of that
naturally
play? I need to see that one.
They did a slightly little version of it.
That was funny.
And then the only big disappointment in drama was that I auditioned for the summer musical Ballet High.
Mm-hmm.
And was that Ballet High, or is that the song
South Pacific.
Thank you. They were doing South Pacific. God, I'm getting old. And we had to audition singing. And so I auditioned and I sang Ballet High. That's why it stuck in my head. I sang Ballet High and everybody couldn't look at me. Their eyes. It was bad.
It was bad?
It was really bad.
Well, I'm a drunk Japanese woman. I mean, that's awesome.
So it's funny. I ran out of there crying.
Aww.
And my drama teacher, Mr. Moore, I don't know.
I remember Mr. Moore, sure.
Yeah, he came running after me. Jerry, stop. No, I'm humiliated, Jerry. Okay, you need some work things. But I'll tell you what, there's a non-speaking role and singing role, no singing or speaking, that I'd like for you to do. Really? Yeah. Do you mind being a nun?
I guess she can play a whole bunch of characters.
And being the warped Catholic that I was,
the warped Catholic.
That was another dream of mine.
To be a warped nun?
Yeah, I was very confused.
Yeah.
But I fantasized about being a nun all the time. I watched the flying nun, the singing nun.
Yeah.
Oh, I can do that.
So did you take the part?
So he told me the only string attached was that I had to provide my own habit.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be difficult.
Your own what? Habit?
Yeah.
What's that?
The black.
The
dress.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I go driving to Placentia Catholic Church, which I was not a member of. And I asked if I could speak to a sister. Okay. Can I borrow your habit for a couple of weeks?
For a couple of weeks.
Needless to say, she was not as giving as I thought she was. But I couldn't get the habit. So I was not a nun.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a bummer.
Yeah, that is a bummer. That's a bummer. Well, they're lost. They're lost.
Exactly.
And what kind of Catholic were you? You didn't know what a habit was?
I don't know what kind of Catholic I was. I know. I'm like, I wanted to ask.
Jerry and I grew up by Rosary High School, which is a Catholic high school, and there were nuns galore. I mean, there were more nuns than fire hydrants throughout Fullerton.
So, oh, yeah, I was born and raised Catholic, went to St. Edward's, got
confirmation and all.
I didn't know. No, I've seen it. I just didn't know what it was called.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just didn't know what it was called.
Okay, well, we've cleared up that.
I just thought it was like a...
Speaking of Catholics.
Yeah.
I was a junior in high school at this time. And my dad worked graveyard shift, as I said earlier. He came home and I was on my way to leave Detroit. He said, where are you going? I'm going to school. Well, you got to cover all the furniture first. Dad! Cover the furniture. He didn't want the pet sleeping on the furniture while he slept during the day. Mm-hmm. Oh, come on. Do it, Jerry. And he goes in his room and goes to bed. All I had to do was walk 7 steps down the hall, open the linen closet, and cover the furniture. BFD. And I was going to, kind of.
Kind of.
But then I saw out of the corner of my eye, there was a sheet on the kitchen table. Thank God I don't have to go down the hall. I grabbed the sheet and pulled it. And 6 pumpkin pies that my mother baked the day before.
Oh, no.
For relatives for Thanksgiving were smashed to the ground. And then I thought, oh, this is a bad thing to happen. So the first thing I did was I went and I got my cat. And I put paw prints in all the pies.
That's actually genius.
In a warped way, genius.
It is genius.
Then I left a note saying, look what Boo-Boo did. Sorry, I didn't have time to clean everything up, but I covered the furniture. I went down. Well,
it's brilliant.
After school that day, I was afraid to come home. Really?
Wonder why.
I went to that same Catholic church in Pleasant. And I asked, can I speak to a priest? So I met with the priest. He actually brought me in and we sat down. What is your problem? I said, well, easy. I have cerebral palsy. Yeah? Okay. Well, you know, sometimes my parents get mad at me because you have cerebral palsy. Well, that's a part of it. And this dialogue going to my head, you're talking to a priest, Jerry, don't lie. So I said, can you please do me a favor, Father? What? And I said, can you please drive me home? And, you know, just take me to the door and just to make sure they're not mad at me
for anything. For anything.
And at that time, my brother David had come home from Vietnam, and he was visiting my mom that evening. My mom and David were the only ones there. I walk into the house in Fullerton with a priest, a church that we don't go to. And I said, Mom, this is Father so-and-so. This is my brother David. And I forget what his name was, but he says to my mom, he said, nice to meet you, Mrs. Jewell. And you are so blessed to have this special child. She is special, you know. And my mom just gave me a look. she said to him, she specialized.
One of a kind.
And he leaves. And my mom calls me over to her. Come here. Come over here. I stand there. Jerry. And my brother David is laughing. He cannot believe that I had the balls to bring the priest home. And my mom says to me, Jerry, when your dad came home, he asked you to walk down the hall, get a couple of sheets and cover the furniture. Mm-hmm. But you didn't do that, did you? But you did that after you pulled the sheet that was right next to you with all the pies. And that wasn't bad enough. Then you had the, I forget what word you used. The audacity. That's a good word.
Yeah.
Mom, just put that in my head. Then you had the audacity to frame the cat. What were you thinking?
That is so funny.
And the punishment was, because I was getting allowance because I couldn't get employed like other teenagers. And the punishment was I had to make 6 pumpkin pies that night. She sent me to the store to buy all the ingredients, and she said that it will come out of my allowance when it's paid off. And my brother David would come in the kitchen and try to help me, and my mom would yell from the other room, you're helping her, David, stop it. She's going to do this whole thing. The only thing I'm going to allow you to do for her is to carry the pies to the oven. That's it.
Wow. Your mom was a tough cookie.
Yeah.
Yes.
In a good way.
Yeah.
In a really good way.
I think one of your I don't know.
Oh, and then she was pissed that I bought a priest home.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot. That was even more.
From a different church.
From a different church.
I'm not clear on your logic how that was going to go for you.
Yeah, it was the fence cat and the priest. She couldn't. And that's what word she used, gal. You had the gal.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's oh my gosh.
That's brilliant. So tell us, we were having lunch once and you told me the story about the very first time you drove. Do you remember with your driver's license?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Do you mind sharing that with our folks, our audience?
Well, I got a license at 17. Well, actually, I had a learner's permit first, like we all do.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not allowed to drive alone without a learner's permit.
Right.
And I came home from school and my mom was asleep, so I thought she'll never know. So I took the car and I'm thinking, God, if I'm gonna be bad, I have to balance it with something good. So I think I'll go to the post office and pick up my parents' mail. They'll be so excited that I did this. And ironically, in that mail that I picked up was my valid driver's license that just arrived from Sacramento.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'm driving home as happy as a lark, so excited that I'm legal. Siren going on behind me. Bulletin Police Department.
Oh, no.
He pulls me over and he asks to see my license. And I'm thinking, what is worse, a learner's permit without an adult or a driver's license that hasn't been taken out of the envelope?
Yeah. It's like, oh, here it is.
So I handed him the unopened envelope. And I said, do you want a letter opener? And because I was a smart aleck and because I moved, he thought that I was drunk.
Oh.
So he goes, can you please step out of the car? Why? Step out of the car, ma'am. So I get out of the car. I'm standing there weaving. Weaving.
We're taking this girl in.
And he asked me if I had anything to drink. I said, a Dr. Pepper. So then he said, okay, I want you to, and he showed me how to touch it, your nose with your finger. Well, I could do it with this one, mm-hmm. but I kept missing that one. And he said, okay, now I want you to walk a straight line. And he's putting one foot in front of the other. And I thought that was so funny. I was just laughing at him.
It's worse and worse and worse.
He said, why are you so humored? I said, well, I mean, you can do that, but I've never walked a straight line in my life. What makes you think I'm going to do it for you? And then he's ready to tag my car and take me in for drunk driving. And I was... Oh, so I ran up to the door of his cop car and I said, hey, what are you doing? Did I tell you to get out of the car? Well, no. But get back in the car until I tell you to move. And I said, but you don't understand. Get back. No, I have cerebral palsy. And his face just, you couldn't even read the emotion. Why didn't you tell me that before? And I said, because you didn't ask. And I said, now can I please go home? Well, I'm still going to give you a ticket. I just told you I'm not drunk. No, 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 no. A different kind of a ticket. What? He said, you were going 50. And at 35 miles on, you get a speeding ticket. Oh, no, no, no. Please. I've only had my license for one day. My dad will kill me. And he said, no, he may bruise you a little, but he isn't going to kill you.
He may bruise you a little bit? Is that what you said?
Yeah. He may bruise you a little, but he isn't going to kill you. And he gave me the ticket. I had to go to traffic school to keep it off my record. And again, I was punished. Even though I was legal, my mom made the point, you were accidentally legal. Ooh.
That's awesome.
That's a funny story.
Yeah, yeah. I had a few run-ins with the Fullerton Police Department. They were tough. They didn't let us kids off. I remember right by your house, I walked across the street against a red light, and there were like 15 of us all going from Troy, just crossing the street, you know, in the crosswalk against the red light. And he gave all 15 of us tickets. Yeah,
wow.
They were a tough crowd.
Yeah, Fullerton and Huntington.
Yeah, and Costa Mesa, don't even go there with me. Anyway, so before we leave high school, you had this wonderful relationship with Gloria. Mm-hmm. And before I ask you my question, from my perspective, it was really an amazing thing. And going to Troy High School in Fullerton, California, Jerry Jewell's a couple years older than me. Is disabled, but, you know, from my perspective, you seem to have a lot of friends, a lot of laughs. You're in the drama department, all that kind of stuff. And Gloria was my age, and Gloria was, she sadly passed away about 5 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. But Gloria was just she walked in a room and everyone knew. I mean, she was so over the top gorgeous.
Yeah, I know.
Over the top gorgeous. And she was also had a kind heart.
Yes.
She was as beautiful. I know it's a cliche, but she was as beautiful inside as she was outside.
That's absolutely 1,000% true.
Yeah. Yeah. And she was like someone that looked like her was kind of intimidating, you know, quite honestly. But then when you got to know her and realize that she was just very down to earth, very funny.
Yeah.
You know, she was all those things. But what did you, before we leave high school, what would you like to share about your memories of Gloria?
Well, in high school was the first time we went to the same school together. Mm-hmm. Never before that point. So that was new. I was known through high school as Gloria Jewel's sister. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you're Gloria Jewel's sister. And so in a way, I kind of resented that. But at the same time, wow, I have a beautiful sister. She's mm-hmm. gorgeous, everybody. And you know, Gloria and I, like I said, I think we were spiritual soulmates. Yeah. We came to teach each other different lessons in life. But she was sensitive. I don't know. I lost my train of thought.
Well, my perspective was that if Gloria was asked by the quarterback to go out on a date and she already had plans with you, she would have. She fiercely loved you. I don't know how a better way to put it.
But she and I had, you know, in high school, we didn't really have a lot to do with each other in high school. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you that for every play that I ever was in, she came.
Yeah.
Sweet. Even in college, every single play, she was there.
So, Jerry, any other thoughts about high school?
Well, you know, they were precious years to me. I mean, I had some wonderful teachers in high school that were friends with me lifelong. A teacher, an English teacher that set me on the right track writing. And I also had Gloria there at the same school. It was such an incredible time. It really was. I even went to Washington, D.C. To meet President Nixon.
While you were in high school?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Did you meet him in person?
Yeah. Well, this... Are we on the air?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes, we are.
Do you remember the OH department at Troy, Orthopedically Handicapped
Department?
That's what I'm talking about. We all raised money to send, I think it was 46 teenagers with disabilities and teachers to Washington, D.C. to meet President Nixon.
Wow.
And we raised the money for all the airline tickets and everything. And so there was a lot of, we didn't get to meet Nixon. And this was when you could take a Ryder truck and just pull up right in front of the White House back in the day.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we had a Ryder truck with all their wheelchairs. And you're talking about, God, probably 18 wheelchair users. It takes a long time to unload all those. So you know, unloading the chairs, putting them in the chair, getting them all ready to meet President Nixon. We're all on the White House lawn, and somebody comes out and says, unfortunately, the president will not be able to meet with you. Sorry, something came up, and he'll send you something in the mail. We were so bummed.
Oh, totally.
You know, I think he was burning tapes that afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something. But what a bummer, though, to go all the way across the country.
That's unfortunate.
Well, no, I think I have a theory as to what happened. I think they didn't get it through their heads that we had that many wheelchair users. And at that time, because I've been back to the White House several times, and at that time, I don't think you could even get a wheelchair in the White House. So looking at this whole crowd, how are we going to do this? That's what I think happened. Mm. Now, the White House is totally within ADA. And you can be a wheelchair user and get anywhere in the White House.
Wow.
Wow.
So maybe that had something to do with it. Who knows?
So.
But that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, but, you know, you have to start somewhere. I look at it, so it took a little while. No?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've never asked you this question before, but for those who don't know, because, you know, honestly, this podcast is doing so well. We've got listeners in New Zealand. We got listeners in the UK, mm-hmm. of course, throughout the US. But Fullerton, where Jerry grew up, is real close to Disneyland. In fact, yeah. I grew up in Fullerton, and you can literally see Disneyland from my parents' front porch. But did Disneyland have any particular fond memories in growing up for you, Jerry?
Yeah, whenever we had relatives come over to visit Disneyland.
Yeah.
Tickets were $10.
Yeah, you know, my brother's coming home from Vietnam twice. Disneyland.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a different deal back then.
It was. It wasn't as expensive.
It was free for us. Because what we would do is, I had siblings that worked there, so we got in for free, mm-hmm. or you knew somebody that worked there. And then once you got in, there was an area right where the tourists were all leaving to go home.
Yeah.
And we had this routine where at the end of the day, we would stand there, and I forget exactly our technique, but we ended up getting all their leftover tickets. Because back then you had to have the E tickets. The A, B, C, D, E ticket.
Yeah, I know.
E was the Matterhorn. E ticket, right? Yeah.
That was the big one.
We picked up on tickets that people hadn't used all day long. So we were loaded with tickets.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I remember going into Disneyland free too. One of our neighbors, I guess, he was the engineer on the train. Because I grew up in Garden Grove.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, till I was like 3 years old, three or four.
Okay. But yeah.
And good times.
I had a great time. And I had a sister who was actually, became an executive secretary. And they had these things at night where you would literally walk down Main Street by yourself or just your family or friends to a theater, which is hidden from view. There's a secret theater. And we'd watch the premieres of movies or Disney movies. And then I remember walking out back to the parking lot. The parking lot was an entirely different place. And we would be literally the only people on Main Street at Disneyland. It was just surreal.
So cool.
Yeah.
That's so cool. It's not like that anymore.
No. It's a zoo. So, and then one thing that your sister Gloria said to me once, Jerry, is that when you were leaving high school, and I want to see if you have the same recollection, your family kind of had two choices with you. And one choice was get you an easy chair and a TV and make life comfortable. And the other choice was, you know, Jerry, you're smart, you're capable, you know, get out like the rest of us and fight, you know, and make something out of yourself in this world. I think we kind of know what option.
Yes.
I mean, is that your recollection? Anything about your parents' kind of big picture overview of your life?
Well, you know, for some reason, when I graduated from high school, my counselors did not believe that I was college material.
Mm.
And go, what do we do with her? Because it was up to the state of California to either have me further educated or to get me a job. It was a new law.
Wow.
And so they put me in a sheltered workshop. And what I mean by that is, you know, putting buttons in a can, stapling it, you know, repeated. And for 2 months, I did that. And to cut to the chase, I got out of that. And I think I got kicked off the bus then, too.
Yeah, I did. I wish we were friends. I wish we were friends back then. It would have been so fun.
You want to get kicked off the bus? Call Jerry Jewell. Call
Jerry Jewell.
So, yeah. What was I talking about?
I don't know. It's college. Kinda, any final thoughts on high school, growing up, you know, Fullerton, all that stuff?
What was I just talking about?
Oh, I don't know. You lost me, too.
How
these high
school. Yeah.
You had a job for 2 months. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You had a job and you buttoning, stapling, and you
yeah,
and get kicked off the
right. It's a mental block.
It's all good.
Yeah. When I finished that program, they put on my state record that I had an attention span of 15 minutes. Sorry, I can't do your show. Sorry, Randy.
Well, keep it under 15 hours.
Yeah, 15 hours.
That I was a model child. This was on my state record. Okay, I'll do it. And there was one more thing that cracked me up. Oh, yeah, it said, and she cannot be trusted with male coworkers.
What? Where'd that come from?
There's a story in there somewhere.
Exactly. That's funny.
But.
That's funny.
Now, there's two sides to that story.
Yeah, I bet there are. Your side and the truth.
No, I was put, now this is their brilliance. They put me in film developing department. Yeah, let's put somebody with a lot of movement.
Yeah, to do developing.
Yeah, I mean, the place is going to go up in flames. So they put me in a dark room. And they also had a wheelchair user who was paralyzed in Vietnam. Mm. And he was working in the dark room with me. Mm-hmm. Now, I was 18 and he must have been in his 20s. Mm-hmm. Gorgeous, gorgeous man. And we were in the dark room. And he said, "You're really cute." "Really? Yeah, you're really cute." I said, "Well, thank you. Nobody ever said that to me before." Mm. He goes, "Haven't you ever kissed anyone? Haven't anybody ever kissed you?" "No." "Okay, I'm going to show you what it's like." He put his lips to mine. The dark room suddenly wasn't dark anymore. Lights went up.
Fireworks going off. 4th of July in the dark room.
Let there be light.
Let there be light.
And on my state record, she cannot be trusted with males.
All right.
Now that's the story.
That's the official version of the story. Yeah, all right.
The story.
Well, the story ends there.
It's awesome.
All right. Well, we're going to start next episode and, you know, college and auditioning for comedy clubs and all of that. But Jerry, I am so, again, thrilled to have you here. I want to thank Tanya, you for being here, our audience. You know, our podcast is new,
yeah,
and we're getting like hundreds of thousands of hits on social media. Yep. PR, our PR stuff is hitting with literally hundreds of networks.
So amazing.
Yeah, it's really great stuff. And I think the reason why is that we talk about this stuff, this trauma that affects, you know, the vast majority of people across the country, and it's not resolved successfully. And that's why you get all the drug addictions and problems. I mean, nobody can argue that trauma has really affected Jerry's life. And but she's a post-traumatic thriver. So we'll get into an episode two right here on Post-Traumatic Thriving, where we dive, survive, or thrive.
The choice is yours.
All right. See you right back later.
Thanks for supporting our podcast. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe, and follow us on your favorite social media. For books, merchandise, or to donate, visit coreiq.com. Post-Traumatic Thriving is produced by CoreIQ, a nonprofit with a mission to teach the life skills we all need but are not taught in school. CoreIQ and the Post-Traumatic Thriving podcast are for informational purposes only and do not provide medical or mental health advice. Always consult with your licensed medical and mental health care providers.